From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Florida's Amendment 4 sparks a furious media battle between supporters and opponents.
We aren't telling lies, we're talking about facts. We have the stories of Florida women who have been denied this kind of care.
Also this week, Governor DeSantis and the state's First Lady turned their attention from Amendment 4 to Amendment 3.
We do not need to legalize another intoxicating substances when we are talking about our children and what is safe for them.
We'll also see why this election might be closer than anyone expected in Florida and learn why the state's getting involved in what authorities say was a planned assassination attempt against former President Trump. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. As voters head to the polls to cast their ballots on a proposed abortion amendment, arguments on both sides are heating up. We hear more on the story from Regan McCarthy.
Well, thank you so much. Please be seated.
Governor Ron DeSantis held a recent rally urging Floridians to vote no on Amendment 4. DeSantis calls the proposal that would enshrine the right to abortion in the state constitution extreme.
There's a lot in this that is not something that most people would find acceptable. And regardless of even what the opinion on it is, you know, these are things that are just flat out wrong to put in a constitution. It's not good policy. It doesn't reflect, I think, the values that people hold. And it's not something that's going to set this state up for success.
The rally follows a series of efforts by the DeSantis administration to block the amendment, including a cease and desist letter sent from the Florida Department of Health to television stations that are airing an ad in support of the amendment, and an ad and website published by the state's Agency for Healthcare Administration that says Florida's proposed amendment, quote, threatens women's safety. DeSantis pushes back on claims from opponents that the efforts are a misuse of taxpayer dollars and misleading to voters.
What it is it's providing information about what Florida law is and the resources that are available under that law. They don't like that because they're lying about what's in Florida law.
We aren't telling lies. We're talking about facts. We have the stories of Florida women who have been denied this kind of care.
Lauren Brinzell heads Floridians Protecting Freedom, the campaign behind the state's abortion amendment. Brinzell says Florida's current law that bans most abortions after 6 weeks is what's endangering women. Abortion advocates say the law's exceptions for fatal fetal abnormalities, to protect the life of the mother, and in cases of rape, are unclear and have caused care to be delayed or denied.
If these exceptions were so workable, why would Deborah Doebert have given birth to a child named Milo who had died within her arms after 94 minutes? Why would Anya Cook have lost half of the blood in her body on the floor of a public restroom because she was denied care? Doctors are afraid right now of going to prison, and they are unable to provide the best medical care possible because of these unworkable so-called exceptions in Florida's abortion ban.
Meanwhile, a report from the Florida Department of State raises questions about potential fraud in the petition process. While nearly a million petitions were validated to get the proposal on the ballot, DeSantis says he doesn't think they all should have been. He says the state's elections police force has found evidence of petition fraud, including petition signatures that don't match the voter's signature on file. Some of those signatures were among those validated by elections officials.
I don't know the extent of it, to be honest. Clearly, you need to get a certain number of petitions to qualify. And most people get more than that. What is the delta from that? And I don't know that we know the answer to that.
Part of the investigation has included police knocking on the doors of people who signed petitions in support of the proposal, a tactic abortion access advocates say is part of an effort to create fear among people who support the amendment and perhaps convince them not to vote. Brinzell sees the attempts by the state as a last-ditch effort to defeat the amendment, which Brinzell believes will win.
Our plan is to share the stories of Floridians who have been impacted by Florida's extreme abortion ban and not fall into the trap that is getting distracted by counter narratives, because we know we're in the right here. Almost a million Floridians signed a petition to get abortion on the ballot because they hate Florida's extreme abortion ban, because they know government went too far, and because they don't want politicians in their doctor's office with them.
Voting on the proposal is already underway through mail-in ballots and early voting. To pass, the measure will need 60% approval. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and First Lady Casey DeSantis have shifted from their opposition to Amendment 4, which would enshrine abortion in the Florida Constitution, to Amendment 3, which, as we heard, would legalize recreational marijuana for adults. As Margie Menzel reports, earlier in this election season, polls showed Amendment 3 passing easily. But since Governor DeSantis and his allies have been working to oppose it, the campaign has tightened.
Recently, the governor held press events in Cape Coral and Fort Myers.
And they'll say, oh, I see these commercials. No one should be put in prison for smoking marijuana. Well, you know, I agree with that. And so I asked the Department of Corrections, our secretary, how many people are currently in prison in Florida for either possessing or smoking, you know, this amount of marijuana? You know the answer to that? Zero. Not a single person in the state of Florida. So that's a total red herring.
On the same day, First Lady Casey DeSantis joined other opponents of the measure in Jacksonville. She pointed to the amounts of money being spent on the campaign by dispensaries that sell medical marijuana in Florida. $100 million by one company alone, she said.
This is a company that wants a return on their investment. That's why they've invested so much. But ask yourselves, if this is truly, again, about freedom, then why is it that when they wrote this amendment, that they say you can only smoke their product, it is illegal for you to grow it at your house, and they give themselves liability protections?
The First Lady was joined by some Florida sheriffs. The Florida Sheriff's Association is opposed to the amendment, but not all law enforcement organizations agree with that stance. According to the language of the amendment, the marijuana treatment centers and other entities would be responsible for producing, selling, and cultivating the product. However, the Vote on 3 campaign has seized on the role of the marijuana treatment facilities. They're the ones who ran this ad.
Giant corporations don't do things out of the goodness of their heart. They do things to make money. And that's exactly why they wrote Amendment 3. Marijuana megacorporations spent $60 million putting Amendment 3 on your ballot. Why? It entrenches their monopoly, bans homegrown pot, and gives special licenses to select corporations. They wrote it, they rigged it, and they're hoping you fall for it. Amendment 3 isn't the marijuana amendment, it's the monopoly amendment.
According to PolitiFact, if approved, the measure wouldn't be a monopoly. The Florida legislature would determine processes for entities to acquire licenses to sell recreational marijuana. The state could license additional medical marijuana entities. Steve Vancor agrees. He's the spokesperson for Trulieve, the giant pot company that has provided most of the funding for the Amendment 3 campaign. The $100 million that Casey DeSantis mentioned.
But what the language does, and understanding when you do a citizen initiative petition drive, you have to drive through a very narrow lane called single subject. It's more complicated than that. But we looked at the prior amendments that the Supreme Court of Florida had rejected. And one of the reasons they rejected them is because it tried to do too many things.
And one of those things, Vancor says, was to mandate homegrown.
So instead, we took a different tack. What the amendment says is it allows the legislature to have entities that are not medical marijuana treatment centers, which could be an individual, it could be a small business, to do a variety of things individually, like cultivate, which is to grow, to distribute, to sell, to possess. So this expands the market.
Jessica Spencer leads the advocacy for the No on 3 campaign and has a background in substance abuse, intervention, and treatment.
it's the wrong message. We do not need to legalize another intoxicating substances when we are talking about our children and what is safe for them. Marijuana is not safe. We are not talking about the pot of yesteryear that's a very low potency. That's not at all what is on the table here. We're talking about high potency products that are also dangerous to young people's brains.
Florida has about 25 licensed medical marijuana distributors with other applications pending. I'm Margie Menzel.
Coming up on Capitol Report, are there possible conflicts between medical and recreational marijuana in Florida? There are some who say there are.
The legislature needs to put guardrails around the medical program so that the licensees do not forget and do not fail to provide the medicine that the Florida patients need.
And Florida's attorney general says it's time state authorities got involved in the case involving a gunman discovered lurking near Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago golf course.
Sometimes states have the ability and the jurisdiction to bring charges and go after maximum penalties that maybe the federal government does not.
Before we depart the wrangling over Amendment 3, we have a few more voices to toss into the mix. The medical marijuana program in Florida is the largest in the U.S. For many of the 100,000-plus seniors in that program, it's about reducing pain or anxiety or helping them sleep. Amendment 3 on the November ballot, of course, would legalize recreational marijuana for adults over age 21, and it would shake up the current, highly regulated system. Joe Burns with Central Florida Public Media takes a look at what that might mean for the more than 880,000 Floridians with a medical marijuana card.
Tom Unrath is a retired Air Force chaplain and Lutheran pastor living with multiple sclerosis. It causes significant pain, but a cannabis chew he takes at night helps with that.
It's not so much a fun thing, but it's a helpful thing. It helps me to feel better and thus have a better quality of life.
Unrath's wife, Anita, is a retired school teacher. She uses a cannabis cream for arthritic knees, plus the soft chew in things like capsules and lozenges.
They won't make you high because they have the CBD and the THC in them. So at 69, we are not at all interested in getting high.
CBD and THC are two of the compounds in marijuana. The THC makes you high. The Unrest support Amendment 3. They also say the medical program is worth saving, that people with serious conditions will need advice on drug interactions. But they aren't sure they'll keep the card themselves. It could depend on how the legislature implements Amendment 3 if it passes. For instance, will a steep tax on recreational weed create a financial incentive to keep the medical card so they can get their marijuana tax-free? And will they need the medical program to get the products they use?
As far as whether or not we'll keep the, you know, paying the $400 a year for the doctor's appointments and the cards, I don't really know. We'll have to see how it works out.
That's $400 a piece. Aaron Bloom runs DocMJ, a medical marijuana practice with offices throughout Florida. DocMJ surveyed patients about the amendment. 74% were in favor of it, 10% were opposed, and the rest were unsure. Their top concern is continued access at affordable prices to the products that give them relief.
The legislature needs to put guardrails around the medical program so that the licensees do not forget and do not fail to provide the medicine that the Florida patients need.
At Curaleaf, which operates 65 dispensaries in Florida, Kareem Bouaziz says they're preparing to meet the soaring demand and lessen the upward pressure on prices.
I think a lot of groups will take the more short-sighted approach and they will chase the higher margin, higher volume products.
But Bouaziz says Curaleaf has no plan to drop the products like topicals and tinctures that medical customers want. The National Conference of State Legislatures says recreational marijuana is legal already in 24 states, two territories, and the District of Columbia. Now the federal government is looking to reclassify it from a Schedule 1 to a Schedule 3 drug, which would open up research, tax benefits, and banking. In Florida, one industry journal says passage of Amendment 3 would create a booming market worth $4.9 to $6.1 billion in the first year.
Should it become recreational, you know, estimates suggest there are probably between, you know, 9 and 15 million potential customers.
That's Jeffrey Sharkey with the Medical Marijuana Business Association of Florida. It'll be a massive experiment, he says. The business model for Florida's medical marijuana program would change. But would it survive? Would the legislature protect it?
And the physicians have to advocate for the value of that as a policy, right? And I know they will.
Sharkey believes it can be regulated to complement recreational use. In Ocala, I'm Joe Burns.
Republicans have a solid grip on power in the Sunshine State, and that has many people wondering how Democrats will fare in the upcoming November election. With early voting underway, longtime Democratic political consultant Beth Matuga joined the Deeper Dive with Derek Kam podcast to discuss the state of play in Florida and national races. Matuga is the general consultant for state House Democratic campaigns and also offered some insight into the Democrats' long game and what keeps her motivated.
Republicans have supermajorities in the House and the Senate.
Yeah.
And they control all the levers of the cabinet and the governor's office.
The whole shebang.
Yeah, they got it all.
Here's what I'll say about the sort of Florida is in play thing. What's the alternative here, right? Like, what do people want us to do instead? Do they want us to just go around saying, you know what, you're right, keep your money. We're done fighting.
Shrivel up.
Yeah,
and
we're done fighting around here.
Roll up into the fetal position.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so as a person who's made a career out of this, you know, I've spent 24 years beating my head against this particular wall. People ask me all the time, why do you keep doing it? Well, because the alternative is to just cede the state to Republicans for literally a generation. And so why do people keep saying Florida's in play? Because the alternative is giving it up for a very, very long. And I want to be clear about what I mean by a generation. I mean, I will be dead before this thing turns around unless we keep fighting. If we roll over and die, all of the things that Republicans have done to the state to enshrine their power will get even more entrenched, right?
Yeah.
So we've made it harder for people to vote. We've made it harder for people to register to vote. We are peeling away civil rights one by one. We've got Nazis flooding the streets with swastikas. No one seems to care about it. All of those things are going to get worse. They're not going to get better. Republicans aren't going to wake up one day and say, you know what, guys, we've gone too far. This is it. We've done too. That's not a concept. There is no bottom for their avarice and greed.
Wow. In play doesn't necessarily mean that Kamala Harris is going to get these electoral votes.
Right.
It means your races.
Sure.
It means your school board races.
Yep.
It means this one competitive Senate race, state Senate race.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's what in play means. You're not getting clobbered.
Again, people ask me, why do you keep doing this? Why do you state legislative races? I literally, this is going to sound insane. I believe that what we're doing, what Democrats could do for the state legislatively will save people's lives and livelihoods. Right. There are things that we are doing in this state that are killing people.
Give us an example.
Well, outlawing abortion. We've got, women in other states bleeding to death in parking lots because they can't get access to health care. We would make that not so here in Florida. Democrats would make that not so. Why do I keep doing this? Why is this important? Why is the distinction between we're flipping Florida blue in one cycle and let's make some incremental improvements? Let's demonstrate signs of life to the national partners so such that maybe they'll look at this and take another look and say, okay, maybe we should send some money down there.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, what we're doing is so these incremental improvements are important. It matters that both bodies of the legislature are in a super minority. It actually matters because we duly elect these people. We send them to Tallahassee in order to speak for their constituents. And when you're in a super minority and the Republicans can waive the rules with a two-thirds vote,
that's right.
Nobody even gets to say anything on the record.
Yeah.
That's fundamentally anti-democratic. But more importantly, it prevents our ability, Democrats' ability, to blunt the most terrible, awful pieces of legislation into something that maybe doesn't kill so many people.
That was Beth Matuga, general consultant for State House Democratic campaigns, on the Deeper Dive with Derek Kam podcast, a product of the New Service of Florida. Hear the full episode wherever you get your podcasts. The top issues for many young adults in this election aren't about culture wars, but their wallets. Inflation and rising prices have hit a lot of people in this age group, and many who can't afford groceries and rent are on the cusp of homelessness. WUSF Steve Newborn talked with some who say they're not hearing candidates address their concerns.
It's rock the vote time on the quad at St. Petersburg College's Gibbs campus. Some students talk about voting for the first time.
And do you vote by mail? Is plenty of voting by mail? Or
it's going to be my first time voting, so I don't really know yet.
But dig a little deeper, and the conversation is about how they're going to afford groceries and find a place of their own to live. Ethan Michael is 19 and is majoring in behavioral studies.
I live in a trailer with five people, and I'm autistic, and so really working hard. I've been homeless three times mostly in my life.
Michael was a cook for a time, but is unemployed now as he hits the books.
Lately, inflation has been, you know, I have to get a job and help support my mom and my sister and my brother, you know, as the oldest son too. Inflation really affects all of us.
He says it's a tough choice this year, but he'll vote for Donald Trump.
I think with Harris, it's just like, no. There's issues about Trump, you know, with the whole last 3 years he has. But with a bunch of other stuff with Harris, I think Trump is a little bit better than Harris.
Democrats have traditionally been able to count on support from young adults, especially college students. But polls show issues like the economy and immigration could be eroding that alliance, especially among young white men. Across the bay in Tampa, it's Democracy Week at the University of South Florida. There, sophomore Olivia Regner sidles up to an information table to learn how to vote. The public health major says abortion, gun laws, and relaxing immigration restrictions are her biggest issues. She was leaning toward Harris, but says she's not hearing enough about her concerns from both candidates.
Before the debate, I was more like sided on one side, and then after the debate, I just have to do more research into it to see like the pros and cons of both sides.
Nearby, Jackie Kuczynski said she just turned 18, so it's her first time voting. Her top concern is pretty simple, just earning enough to get by on her own.
I'm staying at my mom's house, but she does not want me there, and I should leave soon, but I can't find an apartment because I'm like too young and my job doesn't have enough money for me to qualify for an apartment.
And for Jackie, even the price of groceries is out of reach. She has to rack up debt on her credit card just to eat.
Well, rent is insanely expensive. It's like my entire paycheck to cover my month of rent, so I can't afford food. So I get most of my food from the school pantry.
She does plan to vote and says because she's gay, she's leaning towards Kamala Harris.
I think this election is going to change, like, well, more than just the next 4 years.
St. Petersburg College political science professor Tara Newsom says the recent hurricanes have made things worse, but students have been dealing with financial hardship for a long time. She says many of her students are using Florida's public college system as a lifeline to get out of poverty.
They've got one foot in a housing displacement, one foot in a place where they can't necessarily find their next meal readily, and they're coming to school not just to change their stars and transform their lives, but having access to food pantries, having access to dignity and respect that their faculty and their colleges offer to them.
Jackie Kuczynski says if she wants to transform her life by going to school full-time, she'll have to get two part-time jobs. And what's her plan?
Well, I was planning on living in my car, honestly.
How big's your car?
Oh, well, it's not big enough to live in.
For students like Jackie who are struggling to get by, just hearing a candidate with a plan to help students like them would make all the difference. I'm Steve Newborn in Tampa.
With the industry's problems worsened by Hurricane Milton, Florida citrus growers are turning to state and federal lawmakers for help. Florida growers, along with farmers from North Carolina and Georgia, are pressuring Congress to pass agricultural disaster assistance. Florida's citrus growers are looking at losses overall of about 20% from Hurricane Milton, which came ashore October 9th in Sarasota County and crossed the state. Matt Joyner, CEO of Florida Citrus Mutual, says loss numbers are extremely preliminary as they're based on surveys of less than one-third of the acres in the state. The Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services has estimated Milton caused between $1.5 and $2.5 billion in losses for farmers and ranchers, with citrus losses potentially reaching $640 million. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, the state of Florida is taking legal action against the U.S. Department of Justice over its decision to block the state from investigating the assassination attempt of former President Donald Trump at his West Palm Beach golf course. Adrian Andrews tells us more.
Florida's Attorney General Ashley Moody wants a federal judge to allow the state to move forward with its own investigation into Donald Trump's second assassination attempt. The alleged incident took place September 15th at Trump's West Palm Beach golf course.
Sometimes states have the ability and the jurisdiction to bring charges and go after maximum penalties that maybe the federal government does not.
Governor Ron DeSantis set the stage for Moody and her team of state investigators to launch their own probe and bring charges against the alleged gunman. The investigation was set in motion by an executive order signed by DeSantis days after the attempt took place.
We have a strong interest in the state of Florida of bringing this suspect to justice to the fullest extent of the law. The state of Florida has the appropriate jurisdiction to be able to do that.
Moody wrote in her complaint that she was told by federal officials to stop interviewing witnesses. She claims the decision came from the U.S. Department of Justice.
It is very common for state investigators, state prosecutors to work with our federal prosecutors and federal agents on dual tracks with different purposes.
Moody alleges the Justice Department wants Florida to table its investigation until the suspect is federally prosecuted. It's the Justice Department's argument that states shouldn't have first dibs on cases that deal with crimes against federal officials. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland spoke on the case at a recent press conference.
We will all work together to tirelessly determine accountability in this matter. We will spare no resource in this investigation.
Both Moody and DeSantis have publicly ridiculed federal agencies for the way they've handled investigations in the past. In Moody's lawsuit, she recapped the first assassination attempt against Trump at a Pennsylvania rally, which led to a bystander being killed. The state's top attorney then blamed the Secret Service for, quote, allowing the latest attack at Trump's golf course. The Republican lawyer cited court documents that revealed the shooter may have been in the area for nearly 12 hours.
What happened when something went terribly wrong, when someone was allowed to remain on the periphery of a golf course in a tree line for 12 hours and get within 500 feet of the President of the United States?
Moody is no stranger to filing lawsuits against federal agencies. She says the Justice Department is violating a constitutional amendment that protects states from federal overreach. I'm Adrian Andrews.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Joe Burns, Derek Hamm, and Steve Newborn. Technical support for Capital Report comes from Evan Rossi, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.